Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Aaron said to them, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people, whom you brought up from the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I have commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" The Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them, and I'll make of you a great nation." Then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, "O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, 'With evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, 'I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all this land of which I have spoken, I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever.'" So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets which were written on both sides. They were written on one side and the other. The tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets. Now when Joshua heard the sound of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There is a sound of war in the camp." But he said, "It's not the sound of the cry of triumph, nor is it the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear." It came about as soon as Moses came near the camp that he saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger burned, and he threw the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf which they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it over the surface of the water and made the sons of Israel drink it. Then Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought such great sin upon them?" Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself, that they're prone to evil. For they said to me, 'Make a God for us who will go before us.' For this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." I said to them, "Whoever has any gold, let them tear it off." So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. Now when Moses saw that the people were out of control, for Aaron had let them get out of control to be a derision among their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man of you put his sword upon his thigh and go back and forth from gate to gate in the camp and kill every man his brother and every man his friend and every man his neighbor. So as the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Then Moses said, "Dedicate yourselves today to the Lord, for every man has been against his son and against his brother, in order that he may bestow a blessing upon you today." On the next day, Moses said to the people, "You yourselves have committed a great sin. And now I'm going up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make an atonement for your sin." Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if you will forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your book which you have written." The Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin." Then the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. Well, the songs that we have sung together this morning serve as a good reminder for where we are in our journey through Exodus. Oh, worship the King, which was the command, the beginning of the unfolding of the law there in Exodus chapter 19, where God said, "You're going to worship me at this mountain." And that's actually what God intended and what happened. And then he expressed his holiness. We sang, "Holy, holy, holy." And God revealed his character through the law, exposing, revealing so wonderfully kind, in a wonderfully kind way to us, who he is and what he expects of us. And then the reminder that it's only made possible through the blood, the shed blood of Christ, pictured initially on that fateful night at the last plague when the firstborn had to die if there was no blood on the doorpost. And in the expectation that we've been seeing week after week, especially since the law, of the application of that in our life. Take my life and let it be consecrated, completely set apart. That's the expectation for the Christian. I've parted the waters of the Red Sea of God's wrath for your life. Now walk with me. And for several weeks now, we have been peering in, eavesdropping, if you will, on the conversation between God and Moses. Everything that we've seen for the past several chapters, the several times that we've looked at Exodus together, is God describing to Moses who he is in the law, how to apply these laws in everyday life, and then how to construct this tabernacle where God plans to come down and dwell in the midst of his people. But as we approach chapter 32 this morning, there is a dramatic scene change. We've been zeroed in at the top of the mountain, watching this conversation, listening to the conversation between Moses and God. And now that we zoom back off of the top of the mountain and shift our focus down to the foothills, where all of the people have been camping, waiting for their fearless leader, Moses, to return. And that's right where the story picks up this morning. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, we should point out, he was only up there 40 days. It wasn't really all that long, but for them, impatience sets in, which leads to doubt, followed by complaints, and then they take action, taking things into their own hands, requesting from Aaron, the associate pastor, if you will, a few changes to the worship service, going back and doing things the way they used to do it, adding a little bit of the old flare into the way that we do it at the new place, taking things into their own hands, speeding up the pace in order to implement and manipulate their own agenda, attempting to even manipulate the people and situations around them for their own self-promotion. And when we read these opening verses of the people coming around Aaron and saying, "We don't know what happened to Moses, make us a god." And Aaron, for lack of a better summary, says, "Okay. You with me," we have to be thinking, what are you thinking, Aaron? I mean, there isn't even a hint of reservation. Just, okay, if that's what you want. Here's how we start. Gather up the gold. Bring it to me. Here's your god. Tomorrow we'll sacrifice to it. That fast. This is Aaron. He hadn't been kept in the dark about what's going on. Flip back to chapter 24 and you see there, verse 10, Moses, Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, they're sitting, eating, drinking in the presence of God Almighty on the mountain. And here we find him being pressed in, the people gathering around, asking for some alternative form of worship other than what God has demanded. And he says, okay. And he's relaxed about it. In verse 6, we see this, these people are doing the same thing in the midst of their golden calf. They've sat down to eat and to drink and to get up and play. No reservations whatsoever in falling headlong into idolatry. They're waiting on Moses to come back from the presence of God. And they've given up only a moment too soon, it seems. Well, it's obvious for us coming out of the recent study of the law that the first two commandments have to be brought into the equation as we consider this foolish tragedy on the part of the Israelites. I mean, was it not this God who said prior, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol"? Right from the get-go, they are guilty, guilty. Point number one and two, they didn't even jump down to the smaller ones that are a little easier to break. Make us a god. And the first commandment is broken. Aaron made a molten calf, and the second commandment is broken. Now, a couple of things for us to notice here. The words that they use, that these, when they're crowding around Aaron, "Come make us a god who will go before us." As for this Moses, it's not a term of respect. They're not saying, "As for our leader Moses, our mediator Moses, our prophet Moses, our patriarch Moses." No, actually just the opposite. The tone is clear. It is disrespectful, dismissive language. "As for this Moses, we don't know what happened to him. And frankly, we don't care. We want what we want, and here's our opportunity to seize it. Make us a god," or more literally, "make us some gods." They assembled about Aaron. This isn't just some calmly coming around. It was intentional. They gathered together against him in order to convince him to make a god. And he did. "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." He made a molten calf. Now, when we think of calf in our English language, we're thinking of a small, sweet little cow. That's not what it means here. This is a young bull in its prime, a strong god. They wanted a picture of strength, of might. And that's what was fashioned here on the part of Aaron for the people. And then Aaron goes a step further and brashly says, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." He himself, he saw God. He knows this isn't God, and says, "Tomorrow we'll sacrifice to him. We're going a step further." even than what the people asked for. Aaron is attempting to worship the true God using the golden calf. He's attempting to attach God's name to his own false agenda, which we're often guilty of. Assuming that if this is our preference and this is the way we like to do things or this is the way we used to do it, then somehow it must be God's agenda as well. And so we attach his name to it. We're so prone to falling into this same kind of sin that we see here on the part of Aaron. So prone to doing what is popular rather than what is right. I mean, they're pressing in around Aaron. He's one among hundreds of thousands. And his philosophy is not trust in God. It is, if you can't beat them, join them. And so he just gives in. We're so prone to fall into this kind of sin when we do what is popular rather than what is right. Or when we so conveniently forget what God has done and as a result resort to our former wicked ways. I mean, that's what's true. Every one of these Israelites, every single one of them walked through the Red Sea on dry land. Every one of them. And now this grand rescue is in the rear view and they are worshiping a golden bull that can't even say moo. Quickly, conveniently forgot the kindnesses of God. And then we have another dramatic scene shift. Verse 7. We're pulling back away from the masses at the foot of the hill and zooming back in and hearing the conversation that's happening between God and his man Moses. This conversation is picking up if you just look over to the last verse in chapter 31. When God had finished speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written by the finger of God. He'd given to him. He's on his way down. And the conversation picks up. Go down at once, Moses, for your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. God had just given him the law that was going to go in this Ark of the Testimony where God himself was going to dwell. And now he must inform Moses of the situation at the bottom of the mountain. Here's the law, Moses. And by the way, hurry up because they're already guilty of corruption, of turning aside, of idol manufacturing, of idol worship, of blasphemy, and of obstinate rebellion. In verses 7, 8, 9, and 10, every single one of those things is mentioned. God says, this is what your people are up to, Moses. And verse 8 tells us that this turning aside from the way that God had commanded was a quick turning. I mentioned before, there's no reservation on the part of Aaron, nor on the part of people. They were quick to turn, quick to serve another God. They had zero confidence in the real God. And they were quick to turn to whatever would do what they wanted, whatever felt good and pleased themselves. Complaining about how long Moses was taking. Yet God comments on how quick they were to turn away from him. Their timetable and God's timetable was drastically different. Moses was slow to come and they were quick to turn. 40 days is 40 days, no matter how you slice it. In the midst of their corruption and their turning aside and manufacturing and worshiping idols and committing blasphemy by saying this is God, they were obstinate. Unwilling to listen, unwilling to heed good counsel, always offering excuses. Time and again, we see them offering excuses, and time and again, we find ourselves obstinate in the same kind of way when we're guilty of idols sneaking into our lives and they get pointed out. All too often we offer excuses like the people of Israel. Well, it's just the way we are. You have to understand, all those years under Pharaoh, I mean, what can you expect? I grew up in this kind of family. What can you expect? I can't do anything else. It's just the way I am. It's just my personality. It's just my surrounding. It's just my workplace or my classmates or my wife or my husband or my kids. It's not my fault. That's what they're saying. So don't blame me. They're obstinate, always arguing that their situation is different. So somehow they need a different set of rules and regulations, or they have a different expectation on the part of God. Often looking for advice, always asking, what about this? What do you think about this? Willing to hear advice, but rarely following it. It'd be hard for us to argue that we too are not guilty. After God goes out of his way to send Moses down and tells him, by the way, Moses, just a bit of a warning, they're really corrupt and they've turned aside from me and they're making idols and they're worshiping them. They're committing blasphemy and they don't want to hear from anybody. So Moses, in verse 10, let me alone, God says, that my anger may burn. That my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. And hey, Moses, when I destroy them, I'll make you a great nation. When God says, let me alone, Moses, he isn't disappointed with the Israelites and he wants to go away in a corner and sulk. Rather, he's saying to Moses, who, remember, is the mediator between God and the people, Moses, if you leave me alone, I will destroy them. If you leave me alone, Moses, I will burn in my anger and destroy them. And I'll start all over with you, building my kingdom. God was inviting Moses to intercede on behalf of the people. That's what he's doing. Moses, if you leave me alone about this, I'm going to destroy them. But not only was there an invitation offered, but there's a test given as well. Imagine being in Moses' situation. I mean, God is essentially saying, Moses, are you committed? Are you committed to my revealed will, to my plans, to my kingdom? Or are you more interested in your own? I mean, God essentially is saying, Moses, how would you like to become the second Abraham? How would you like to start all over and be the chief patriarch, so that everyone refers to themselves as the children of Moses rather than the children of Abraham? I mean, here were the options. Moses, you can make a name for yourself. Or Moses, you can pray for your people, for the people of God. And Moses, like so many other times, chooses God's greater glory over his own personal benefit. He humbled himself and entreated the Lord. Verse 11, Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants to whom you swore by yourself. God, you said to them that you would multiply their descendants as the stars of the heavens and all this land that you've been speaking about. You said that you would give it to their descendants and that they would inherit it forever. So the Lord changed his mind. The Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people, which should make us go, he did what? This is a God who doesn't change. But it's important for us to realize here that this is not some fickle situation on the part of God, where he didn't know what he was going to do and he was going to adjust his plan based on what his man Moses did. God planned to rescue them all along. Moses wasn't changing God's plan as much as he was carrying them out. Even the word changed here, or maybe your translation says God relented. In the original, it carries with it this notion of being moved to pity and compassion for others. Moses going to God in prayer is stirring up that pity, reminding God of the compassion that he has for his people. I mean, we tend to talk about prayer from time to time, and I find it really valuable, personally and corporately, for us to consider these remarkable prayers that we have in the Bible. First, regarding Moses, it's worth noting what Moses did not do when he went to God. He makes no attempt to minimize the idolatry. Moses doesn't one time make a single excuse for their sin. He doesn't say, but God, it took 40 days for you to tell me these three pages of things. He doesn't make any excuse whatsoever. He doesn't say, God, you know their background. You know how long that they watch the Egyptians worship. It's all they know, God. Take it easy on them. He doesn't make a single excuse. He made no effort at justifying their rebellion. He didn't suggest that God's demands weren't fair. He didn't say, God, you just rescued them from a miserable life of slavery, and now you've put these harsh, strict commands on them. How do you expect them to keep them? He didn't suggest that God's demands were too difficult or too stringent or unfair. Nor did he argue based on the merits of the Israelites. He didn't one time say, God, they followed you this far. Give them a break. I mean, they did put blood on the doorpost. They've done that. They did walk through on dry land. They did eat the manna. They did drink the water when you provided. Moses did not attempt to argue based on the merits of the Israelites. Not only is it helpful to see what Moses did not do, to an even greater degree, it's helpful for us to see the approach that Moses did take when he goes to the mercy seat of God on high. Moses approaches God with an appeal to God's affection for his children as a father. Verse 11, why does your anger burn against your people? Again, Moses is turning this back on God. Look at verse 7. God speaking to Moses says, go down, your people whom you brought up, they've sinned. And God turns it right back around and said, no, God, they're not my people. They're your people. Your reputation is on the line. You're their father. You have shown time and again that you're compassionate, that you have a great affection for them. And that's what Moses is doing in petitioning God. Moses knows the revealed character of God, and he's using that as a strong plea in his approach to the king. An appeal to God's affection, and then a petition based on God's previous investment. The second half of verse 11. Your people, whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand. He goes to God, petitioning based on the prior investment. God, you've invested so much. You exerted so much energy. You showed so much strength, so much might. You parted the Red Sea. You caused the wrath to close in on the Egyptians, and every one of them was killed. And Moses says, don't stop now, God. Continue flexing your muscles, as it were, showing yourself strong and omnipotent. Continue displaying your great power among your people. An appeal to his affection, a petition based on previous investment, and then a reminder of his reputation among the Egyptians. Verse 12. Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Would not the Egyptians say that? I mean, what a great basis for prayer. Moses says, God, what are the Egyptians going to say? You've done so much only to bring them out here in the wilderness and then destroy them? What kind of sense does it make? God, the Egyptians are not going to see you for who you really are if you do this. So God, based on your own reputation, based on your kindness, your love, your glory, who you are essentially and morally, God, act in light of who you are. Don't do this. Don't destroy your people. A reminder of his reputation among the world, among the Egyptians, and then a call to merciful compassion. The second half of verse 12, turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Turn from your anger. It's as if Moses, meeting with God there on the mountain, can see the anger boiling. And Moses is confident that the anger is real and right, or righteous anger, and that the people deserve it. But Moses also understands that he is a compassionate God. He himself has revealed that about himself. He says he is slow to anger and full of loving kindness and compassion. And Moses is taking him to task on that. God, you have said that you're compassionate God. Turn from your anger. It says you're slow to anger. Be slow, God. Here's where you want to apply that, God. Be slow about your anger. An appeal to his affection, a petition based on prior investment, a reminder of his reputation, a call to merciful compassion. And then finally, verse 13, a plea based on God's promise. Remember, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or Israel, your servants, God, you said to them, this is your promise. Here's a perfect example of pleading the promises of God. Moses does it. God, you said that you would make them a great nation. That doesn't happen if you destroy them. Remember? Remember, God, what you said, that you were going to give them all this land. If you destroy them, not only will the land be taken over, but you can't give it to them. God, remember the promises that you've made. A great example on the part of Moses of how not to pray, how not to go to the throne, and how to go, how to petition, how to remind him, how to plead the previous promises that he's made. If you notice in the reading from the prayer meeting in Psalm 106, I want to quote just a few verses beginning in verse 19, where this story is summarized several years after it had happened. They made a calf in Horeb and worshipped a molten image. Thus they exchanged their glory for the image of an ox that eats grass. He doesn't really eat grass because he's golden. They forgot God, their Savior, who had done great things in Egypt, wonders in the land of Ham, and awesome things by the Red Sea. Therefore, God said that he would destroy them. Had not Moses, his chosen one, stood in the breach before him to turn his wrath away from destroying them. Moses responded to God in supplication and in intercession, pleading with God. And it's then that he turns and goes down the mountain where God had called him to go. Back in verse 7, go down at once. And when Moses shows up on the scene, he acts just like we would expect him to, righteous anger, being angry without sin. Now, Moses didn't always act in anger without sin. Again, if you remember back to the psalm that we looked at in the waters of Meribah, we see Moses acting out in such great anger that he loses his privilege of going into the promised land. But here, Moses acts out in righteous anger, and rightly so. He's in rage. And the picture is clear. He sees what's going on. His heart is broken. He realizes that the Israelites have broken covenant with God. The law of God is shattered. Not chipped on the corner. Not just a few cracks in a couple of places, but shattered into 1,000 pieces. They were guilty of breaking the whole law, even though maybe they had only broken it at a point or two. James 2:10 makes this reality true for us as well. And then Moses proceeds to liquefy this golden calf and force them to consume it. What a great picture. He ground it like powder, burned it, put it in the water, and made them drink it. A great picture, not as a literal solution for dealing with idols, but the portrayal of absolute riddance at all cost. I wonder when the last time is that you could be found guilty of absolute riddance in regard to your idols. Idols are not meant to be tolerated, not in the slightest. They're meant to be annihilated or obliterated. Our approach all too often is we just merely shove them in the closet rather than taking them out with the trash and being done with them. I mean, sure, when you shove it over in the closet or under the bed for a little while, the room looks a little cleaner, but the reality is the idol is easily accessible because the necessary measures have not been made to get rid of it completely. So when it hasn't been taken out and obliterated, it's only a small measure of temptation that rises up. And we walk over and turn the doorknob and boom, right back deep in the sin. And so the gossip tells more rumors. And the drunk picks up the bottle again. And the lustful man goes back to the pornography. And the greedy cheats another person in a business deal. And the unhappy lady binges again on food or shopping or whatever. The Israelites never, ever had a chance to go back to this golden calf. Why not? Why not stop dabbling with the idols and destroy them instead? A great pattern set by Moses here for us to follow. I mean, that's what the apostle wrote to the church at Corinth. This is here for our benefit so we don't make the same mistakes. That's why we're looking at it. Our story is tied up in here so wonderfully. So after Moses has dealt with the masses, then he turns to his brother to deal with Aaron. And the approach of Moses to Aaron, I find interesting because he didn't do as I would be prone to do and say, as I said to start, "What are you thinking? Have you lost your mind? It's all your fault. Can I not trust you with anything?" Now, Moses knew that Aaron was fully responsible as the leader of the people, but he also knew that the influence from the people must have been tremendous. And so Moses, in approaching Aaron, has compassion and he has understanding. Yet with the compassion and the understanding with which he approaches Aaron, he does not allow any wiggle room for shirking the blame or for Aaron making any excuses. It's the ideal confrontation. No room for any excuses, but a real understanding of where Aaron was and the pressure that was on him. But even though it was a confrontation that was ideal from Moses to Aaron, the response was quite a bit less than ideal, which again offers us a wonderful example of how not to react or how not to confess sin. Moses comes to Aaron. "What did this people do to you that you've brought such great sin upon them?" And Aaron turns on Moses for pointing out the sin. "Back off, little brother. Relax. I mean, come on, it's not that big of a deal. Don't be angry at me." But Aaron all of a sudden is making it a personal issue with Moses. And if you've ever pointed out sin in someone else's life, you probably know that this is one of the first things that happens. He was also attempting to appease Moses. You calm down. Don't let your anger burn. As if Moses' anger was anything compared to the anger and the judgment of God that he was under. God was the one with the issue regarding this sin, the primary one. Aaron turned on Moses and then he immediately begins to blame others. Don't let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself. You know they're prone to evil. They said, make a God for us. We don't know what happened to Moses. We don't know what's become of him. We see this in the fall originally with Eve blaming Adam, or Adam blaming Eve, blaming Satan. No one owning up to the responsibility. That's what Aaron's doing. Aaron is doing here. It's all their fault. They made me do it. Excuses, excuses, excuses. That's all we hear from Aaron. And that there's some truth in the excuses. He's not lying. He's actually quoting verbatim from the beginning of the chapter. He says exactly what they said. But his partial confession is clouded with excuses, trying to relieve himself of the burden of the blame that he deserves. He's turning on Moses, blaming others, and then he proceeds to deny the extent of his own involvement. In detail, word for word, Aaron gives the specifics regarding the people's sin. Verse 23 is verbatim from verse 1. But when it comes to Aaron's involvement in this great scandal, he's not so specific. If you look at verse 24, whoever has any gold, let them tear it off. They gave it to me, I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. Go back and look at 2 through 4. Aaron said to them, tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters. I mean, the specificity is already greater. And bring them to me. Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears, brought them to Aaron. He took this from their hand. He definitely left this part out. And fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. He fashioned it. That is, he built a mold. He designed a mold so that they could pour liquid gold in it and it would hold it. And then took a graving tool after they had taken the mold off and finished all of the fine tuning details. And he describes that as threw the gold in and the calf came out. I mean, you wonder why Moses didn't say, let's see that again. Aaron outright lies about his involvement. I mean, he was guilty even if he was only involved minimally. But he was far more entrenched in this sin than he was willing to confess. And he avoids all of the incriminating details by abbreviating his role in the incident. Now consider how pathetic this is. Aaron, the mouthpiece of Moses, who has a way with words, finds himself short of the words required for a full explanation and a right confession because he was intentionally deceptive. I mean, as God tells the story of what's happening here, when he's telling Moses, this is what your people are doing, Aaron plays the starring role in the story. But when Aaron retells the same story, he has this minor character, it seems. We only have to look at the last verse in the chapter to see, again, who made the calf. The Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf, which Aaron made. God said in the beginning, Aaron made it, and he said again, even though Aaron had denied it, in the end, you're guilty, Aaron. You made the calf. Now, we're not going to pursue the second half of the chapter today, but I do want to mention a few things in closing regarding idolatry and confession and prayer. I mean, those are the major themes that we see here in the chapter. Beginning with idolatry or the struggle with sin, it's impossible for us to say it enough that the struggle with sin for the glutton is not in the pantry or the refrigerator. And the struggle of sin for the porn addict is not in the magazine or on the internet. The struggle with sin, your struggle with sin, whatever the idol is in your life, is in your heart. Sure, you may be verbally promising again and again to serve God, and you may assume with all your might that your motives are sincere and that they are from within, but you are actually, as Stephen said moments before he died to the leaders in the Sanhedrin, you're unwilling to be obedient to him, disregarding him, and in your hearts turning back to Egypt. The absence of Moses gave the Israelites an opportunity to openly worship what they had been worshiping in their hearts all along. It wasn't some new thing that they decided to do. They'd been looking back to Egypt all along. It proved that they had been taken out of Egypt, but Egypt was deeply entwined in who they were. They had yet to trust fully and exclusively in God and who He was for them. Sin is far better defined as who we are as opposed to what we do. And when we begin to understand that it's who we are originally, by nature, as a result of Adam's fall, then we will begin to realize that there's an issue deeper and there's a bigger problem than just the things that we're doing. What we're doing is bad, yes, and it's an offense to God, but it's only a result of what's on the inside. The root is the real issue, the pride and the unbelief that lays low in the heart and hides in the dark corners and the crevices. If we don't deal with sin and rebellion and immorality and idolatry there, we aren't dealing with the problem. When we do things the way that we prefer, as opposed to God's clear commands, our worship will continue to be contaminated. Our gifts that we offer to God will continue to be corrupt, and our morals will end up compromised. Every time. There's probably not a single person here this morning whose great danger is fashioning an actual golden calf this week. And there's not a single person here who isn't in danger of attempting to refashion God to your own specifications and desires. And that's just as idolatrous. And it is dangerous. Wanting God to teach our minds, but not transform our lives. Wanting a spiritual lift on Sunday morning without submission to His commands during the week. Longing with our whole heart, it seems, for Him to change others, but not wanting Him to really do the hard work of changing us. Wanting His love without holiness or His mercy without justice. It is idolatry, and we are guilty. This story of the Israelites here in Exodus 32 is our story. We are idolaters who were floundering around in rebellion towards God. Yet God, when we were floundering around in rebellion and fighting Him around every corner, God who sees all and knows all, saw us wallowing in our miserable state. And He sent His Son. While we were still sinners, at the right time, He was born of a virgin at the fullness of time, so that whoever, man, woman, boy, or girl, believes in Him, whoever believes in Him will not perish, but have everlasting life. Exodus chapter 32, verse 7. Moses and God talking on the mountain. God sees what's going on down below and says, Moses, go down For us, it's become far different. Not a mere man like Moses. Sure, he was faithful in his house, but we've been given a better mediator than Moses, one who was faithful in the whole kingdom. And at the right time, when we were at the height of our sinful career, as it were, God says, go down, not Moses, but go down Jesus. For your people, whom I gave you as an inheritance, they've become corrupt. They're living in sin. They're turning from my law. They're worshiping other gods. You go down, son. You go down, Christ. You, Jesus, go down and save them from their sin, or they will be swallowed up in my wrath. Our story of redemption is here. And then it continues later at the end of the chapter. Moses says to the people, you've committed a great sin. And now I'm going up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people has committed a great sin. They've made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if you will, forgive their sin. And if not, please blot me out from your book, which you have written. Again, we haven't had a great mediator like Moses, but we've had one far better than Moses, who was actually blotted out. And God turned his back on him that day on the tree, and he poured out every bit of his wrath, punishing the sin of the world, so that we might be redeemed and be children and continually, constantly, day after day, moment after moment, year after year, for all of eternity, live unto and in and with the living God. Go down, Jesus, and save your people. And he has, and he still is. May God help us to live on these few truths that we find here in Exodus 32. Let's pray.